This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. The late Paul Anderson, who died on July 31, 2001 at the age of 74, is considered one of the greatest science fiction authors of the 20th century. Winner of 7 Hugo Awards and 3 Nebula Awards, he even has an asteroid named in his honor. Known for his hard science fiction writing, in particular his Polysotechnic League series, as well as his Landry series and his Time Patrol series, he was also a master of fantasy, and there were also historical novels and mysteries. His career began in 1947 at the age of 21 with stories in Astounding Science Fiction, and he became a professional writer a year later. One of his novels became a film, the Hugo-nominated The High Castle. It was adapted in 1994, and while it's not currently streaming, if you search, you can find a DVD copy. As with many of the writers of the pulp and paperback era, Paul Anderson is ripe for rediscovery. After Probabilities got its start in 1977, it was natural that the Orinda-based writer would become a guest on the show, though his libertarian politics put him at odds with much of the KPFA audience. This conversation with co-host Lawrence Davidson, recorded June 10, 1978, was likely Davidson's very first solo interview. For some unfathomable reason, Lawrence seemed to keep turning the focus to Anderson's politics, to which the writer finally explained, a little exasperated, that he was basically a storyteller.
Did you originally plan your Polysotechnic League stories as a future history, or did it just fall into place like that?
Well, a little bit of both. Originally, I had just written one or two stories about Von Rhein, and then it occurred to me that the same background of a future society could be used for other stories. And then somewhat later it happened that I had actually from an earlier period been writing some stories set in the twilight of a terrestrial galactic empire. Those are mainly the stories with Dominic Flandry as the hero. It suddenly occurred to me that perhaps Von Rhein had lived several centuries before on this same timeline and might be remembered as a folk hero or folk villain, somewhat in the manner of Robin Hood. So on an impulse, I wrote that in. And after that, I was hooked. And then when I saw that some kind of structure was beginning to evolve, I realized I'd better give it some very systematic thought and start keeping notes and so on. So by now it is a historical scheme which covers several thousand years of the future, and my notes in it overflow quite a large loose-leaf binder.
I was wondering, who is the prototype for Von Rhein?
Oh, no individual. I never put real people into stories, even under different names. That's a bad idea. But of course, one draws on people one has known or read about or whatever. Basically, though, Von Rhein is more or less typical of the age of discovery in actual history. The Reformation period in Europe saw a great many people very much like him. Physically, he's pretty much modeled on King Christian IV of Denmark, who had a good many of the same personality traits, too.
In your future history, the capitalists are exploiting out of space. Also, in Heinlein's The Man Who Sold the Moon, why do you feel that today's capitalists are avoiding the opportunities to do likewise?
Oh, there's a variety of reasons. As a matter of fact, a number of small companies are in existence, organized by people who hope to get into space on a free enterprise basis. They're as an outfit calling itself the Foundation, for instance, back in the Midwest, which is devoted to propagating this idea. There's Earth Space out here down in Palo Alto and a number of others. So it's not that there's nobody that wants to. It's that so far the opportunity is lacking. As for the large corporations, a number of their executives are quite interested too, but basically they're letting the government, which is to say the taxpayer, first pick up the bill for all the research and development. By the way, I might remark that since your audience is so largely in the Berkeley area, I might remark that perhaps it's a little bit of a loaded word to speak of capitalists exploiting the resources of space, which is, would socialists be doing anything different as far as those resources are concerned? I would prefer a neutral term like using them.
You mentioned in a recent interview that the Polytechnic League's rise and fall is parable of America. I believe it was SF Review 27. I was wondering how you meant that.
Oh, I really don't know to what extent history in the real world has tended to repeat it. I'm not sure anybody knows, repeat itself. I'm not sure anyone knows because it's so much a matter of interpretation, but certainly some kinds of development have frequently tended to recur, especially after a society gets locked into what's called a universal state. So let's say that to some extent I have simply drawn some analogies. Now, of course, my assumption that a highly libertarian society is going to come about in the future is only an assumption for story purposes. I have no idea whether it is possible or probable or anything. Nobody can really predict what's going to happen. So I assume that since no human institutions have yet developed that didn't contain the seeds of their own destruction, and I doubt that any ever will, I went on to examine how this libertarian society could eventually bring about its own downfall. And of course, here in America in the last 100 years or so, we've been witnessing the same sort of thing happening. It's still grinding on, but it probably hasn't far to go now. So to draw certain parallels was an obvious thing to do. By the way, I am taking some care here to say libertarian rather than capitalist. Capitalism, or perhaps in a broader sense, a more accurate sense, free enterprise, is integral to a free society, since freedom of economic activity is itself a liberty. That's by no means what freedom in the larger sense is all about. Oh, and I should add, too, that don't really want to preach a sermon to anyone. I'm just a storyteller.
How have you been affected by the science fiction boom?
Favorably. That is to say, I get far more offers to write things than I can possibly do anything about. So I'm actually doing quite well. And could do better, but I just don't want to write an awful lot. But there are so many other things to do in life also.
Oh, in the past year and a half, I've seen quite a few of your books come back into print.
Yes, there's a number of reissues. So it would look as if I were terribly prolific. But actually, if you look at the copyright dates, you'll find most of these were done a long time ago. And in fact, since I've been writing for about 30 years, it's no wonder that the list of books has gotten a little long, but I have colleagues who produce at many times that rate.
Do you have any feeling about how long this boom's going to last?
No, I hardly think it will continue at its present level indefinitely. After all, there have been science fiction booms in the past, which were followed by busts. On the other hand, I would expect us to end up with a larger audience than we ever had before. Oh, and there's another matter, too, that more and more science fiction is re-merging with the so-called mainstream out of which it originally came, after all. Or you might say the mainstream is merging with it, either way you want to look at it. All these science fiction concepts that used to be so far out, robots, space travel, time travel, androids, cloning, the whole works, these are common currency nowadays. So I think there's going to continue to be a great deal of science fiction which simply doesn't come out under that label.
And I think the more reality follows what people have been writing about for so long, that there'll be a renewed interest in certain types of science fiction. I know in the bookstore that I work in, we sell a lot of computer books, a lot of data manuals and whatnot. And it's right next to my science fiction section. And people will come and they'll pick up a few programming books, and they'll turn around and they'll pick up a few science fiction books. And there are borderline books. There's collections of science fiction stories about computers and about robots. And
oh, yes.
It's this really interesting merging that I see going on.
Yes, I would not want to get all messianic about science fiction. It's only one kind of literature among many other kinds. But I will say that it does have two things going for it. It usually tells a story in which events actually happen to people you can care about, and that is not too easy a thing to find anymore elsewhere. Then also, to some extent, it does symbolize or express something about this world we live in today. You could pick up the average kind of novel that they teach in English courses, the average Here and Now novel, and read it. Undoubtedly be a very good book, but it would give you no idea whatsoever that we're living in the middle of the Third Industrial Revolution, that our concept of reality is being completely revolutionized on every scientific front, that as far as society goes, the fountains of the great deep are being broken up. Science fiction does have something to say about all those things.
One thing that also is a nice trend that I see developing, at least here in Berkeley, is the amount of pop science books. I don't really know if that's the right handle to put on it, but things like Gerard O'Neill's High Frontiers and books on space colonies, books on cloning, books on life extension are just picking right up, and some of the people who are picking them up are people who will turn around and also read science fiction books. And it just seems to me, being that I read both, that after a while you can't make the distinction anymore. You know, it's like right now we're living a science fiction story.
Yes, I find a certain amount of encouragement in this interest in real science among the general public. When a book like, say, Carl Sagan's The Dragons of Eden becomes a bestseller, I think that's a good sign.
Is there any book that you would really like to write that you haven't gotten around to writing yet?
The next one. It's always that way. I have just recently completed a large novel, which is, you might say, very hard science fiction, hewing quite closely to genuine science as of this year, even though some of it is way out on the frontiers of relativity theory. So having done that, I'm at this moment working on a novel which is pure fantasy, strictly a fairy tale.
Is there any special direction that you see yourself going in politically in terms of fantasy or science fiction?
I mean, I have in some quarters gotten a certain reputation as being quite a Tory. Actually, I think of myself as being a libertarian. But as I believe I remarked a little earlier, I don't really want to preach. Science fiction writers don't want to buy sermons. They can get those in church. They want stories.
In most of your stories, you deal in science accuracy. Who do you see as the best writers around now in terms of science? I asked Greg Benford this. He said, Niven was the best and George R. R. Martin was the worst.
Larry Niven is good, certainly, in that line. Greg Benford himself is. He's a physicist by trade, after all. Jerry Pournelle, who used to be an engineer. For that matter, I have noticed quite sound scientific grounding in the work of Ursula Le Guin.
If you could go back through your Future History series, is there any sequence of events you would like to change? And do you sometimes feel it frustrating that you've mapped out the whole thing already?
Well, as to the first part of your question, the answer is probably no. What would be the point of changing it? If I want to move into a different universe, I do it. As a matter of fact, this Future History thing is only one part of the whole body of my work. The majority of books exist independently of it and of each other. It is true, though, that as something like this keeps growing, one becomes more and more constrained simply by the need to stay consistent. Indeed, in spite of all my efforts, from time to time, eagle-eyed fans do point out to me that two different stories don't quite jibe with each other on this or that point, to which my standard reply is, perfect consistency is possible only to God himself, and a close study of Scripture will show that he doesn't always make it.
What's your favorite Future History story besides your own?
Oh, do you mean single story or...
Well, other Future History.
Oh, well, that would have to be the Heinlein one, of course, which, after all, is the prototype of this sort of whole sort of thing. Let's see, that most of those have been collected in one volume now, haven't they? The Past Through Tomorrow, a very good book. Of course, the history in Asimov's Foundation series and related books is quite interesting, too.
There's also Stapleton's Last and First Men.
Oh, yes, yes. I'm a great admirer of Stapleton. And, of course, we should not overlook Gordon Dixon's Dorsai series, which is turning into quite a monumental thing, and Larry Niven's Known Space series, a lot of fun to read, too.
I was wondering how you felt about parodies. Because I know there's a parody which I always felt was aimed sort of at The High Crusade, a book by Chester Anderson and Michael Curlin called 10 Years to Doomsday. It seemed not so much a parody, but it seemed like almost that it could be a tongue-in-cheek rewrite of a Paul Anderson story.
I haven't seen it. You've got me interested now. It's possible. And if so, personally, I would feel rather flattered that someone was interested enough. Actually, a good parody, in a sense, has to be a labor of love. I've done a few myself of others, though usually not for publication.
Okay, and people out there listening would like to hear, and what's your favorite Paul Anderson story?
Oh, isn't that a bit like asking the parent of a number of children who the favorite is? I like to think that the best thing I've ever written is the one that I'm currently working on. That isn't always true, of course. And then there are so many personal associations. So, to some extent, I would have to go by just reader reaction over the years. So, for example, Three Hearts and Three Lions has been quite popular, so it must have something going for it. I'm personally quite fond of A Midsummer Tempest, if only because it was a rather brash literary experiment. And this forthcoming novel of mine, not yet published, The Avatar, I think has a good bit in it, at least I hope so. There are many others, and I really think it would be up to the reader to choose, not the author.
If there was somebody out there who had never read any of your stories, what would you think they should read first?
It would be a little hard to say because it would depend on the person, what that individual's particular tastes and interests were. Well, for example, if you like fantasy and adventure and a certain amount of humor, you might enjoy Three Hearts and Three Lions. If, on the other hand, you like, let's say, hard science, a great deal of nuts and bolts in the thinking, then, say, Fire Time would be a possible book for you, since an imaginary planet is constructed in great detail. I would suggest to a reader who's looking for something by a particular author, not necessarily me, that this person go browse the bookstore, sample a few pages of this and that, and decide what he or she is likely to enjoy.
A book of yours that comes up quite frequently is Tau Zero.
Yes, that practically a prototypical hard science book, although several people who admitted to me that the physics of it got a bit beyond them said that just the same they liked the people there.
Yeah, I know personally I got lost.
Really? Well, sorry about that. I tried to make it clear. As a matter of fact, the book is used in at least one class that I know of, which is in physics, as one approach to giving students some idea of what relativity is about.
You've been listening to an interview with the late science fiction author Poul Anderson, who died in 2001 at the age of 74. He was interviewed by the late Lawrence Davidson and recorded for Probabilities on June 10, 1978. Many of Anderson's novels and collections are still in print. The interview was digitized, remastered, and edited on February 22, 2026. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.